And be recorded, I guess. I don't know what's going on. I also want to introduce some newcomers to our faculty. Krista Paravani is over here. Krista, a little Miss America type of thing. She has joined us as an assistant professor of creative nonfiction. And then Caroline Randall Williams. I don't know if Caroline's here. She's a visiting assistant professor in poetry. And we're happy to have them both with us. On your program, I think the flip slide shows all of our upcoming readings, but I don't think it includes the COW reading, the Council of Writers, the graduate organization for Masters of Fine Arts students, and that reading is in, correct me if I'm wrong, Andrea, September 30th, a Wednesday at 7:30 at 123, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, okay, good. So we hope we'll see you there as well. I had this big spiel, which for me is like three sentences, that's a lot, but about how we're celebrating Mark's latest book, which of course has won an award. He, like every 6 months, there's a new book and it's won something, and it's like, what is going on here exactly? And that, you know, Mark is one of our own, but then also that Faith was as well, because I had this memory of Faith being here many times, but that's not true. She tells me she never leaves her mountain cabin. So I think it's just that we bonded so much that one time we had that fancy dinner together, remember that? So in any case, we are celebrating Mark's latest book, and we are so happy to have Faith with us, who's a lovely poet, and actually is on Garrison Keillor, you know, which I can't do that for whatever reason. So anyway, I'm going to turn things over now to our introducers. Elizabeth Leo is going to introduce Faith, who will read first, and then Megan Fahey is going to introduce Mark. Thank you so much for coming.
Microphones. Scare me. In her poem, A Strange Rain, from her newest poetry collection titled Telling the Bees, Faith Sharon writes, I felt differently about the world when I learned it could rain animals. I feel a little differently about the world every time I read one of her poems. I feel full and calm. Sharon's poems have what Jim Harms might refer to as real caloric value. Her poems are those things we say, are all those things we say about the poetry we love. They are tender, funny, sometimes brutal, always inviting and engaging, and so on and so on. One gets the sense that Sharon is as devoted to her reader as she is devoted to her subject material. Her family members, dogs and animals she writes about, the places she's lived, her experiences of motherhood, of gender, and poverty. Sharon's collections are those that should be transmitted into space, to be found by extraterrestrial life. Her poetry would tell the story of what it means to be a human being. As Mark Brazaitis writes in praise of Sharon's Telling the Bees, she, quote, conjures a place where she would feel most at home. In the town where I belong, the radio would have a Faith Sharon station. I would listen and learn and laugh and know myself to be in gentle and profound company. We are very lucky to share that company tonight. Faith Sharon is the author of four books of poetry. Her first collection, The Owl Question, won the May Swenson Award, judged by Mark Doty. Her second book, The Empty House, was published in 2008 from WordPress. Her third collection, Moving the Piano, was published in 2011 through the Stephen F. Austin State University Press, as was her most recent book, Telling the Bees, published this year. As Marianne mentioned, her poems have been featured on Garrison Keillor's The Writer's Almanac, and she has awards from the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, the Barbara Denning Memorial Fund, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Please join me in welcoming Faith Sharon.
Thank you for that introduction. It was a great introduction. I used to have to write those for writers when they would come to the Work Center. They're hard to do. You did a really lovely one. It was moving. Okay. So I think I'm going to start with a poem called Gravity is Getting Stronger. It's a poem about getting older, which I am. And the title came from a headline I read in the National Enquirer. I like to read the National Enquirer headlines when I'm in line at the grocery store. Gravity is getting stronger. You may have noticed how weak you feel in the morning, how each of your feet weighs as much as unhappiness. Maybe your coffee cup is as heavy as a lie, or your morning paper is made of stone. Once you're middle-aged, gravity increases. This is why you do not skip or run squealing across the lawn in the evening, your laughter weightless. You're the opposite of the astronaut who floats in a rocket with windows made of perspective. You cannot admire the delicate greens of Earth, cannot see the moon's white beach. Even the couch your grandmother gave you so many years ago is full of memory and cannot be lifted. Even the promises you made so easily have gained weight. At first, gravity was what kept you from floating away, but now it is the thing that reminds you of all the places you will not go. It is as relentless as the seasons, which will not stop twirling, determined to make you dizzy. Okay, I'm moving on to love, but I have to have water. This next poem is called Heart Island. Between New York and Canada are the Thousand Islands, each one about the right size for a house with a yard, each one owned by a person who imagined a life surrounded by water. Among these, Heart Island has a castle where no one lives. It was built by George Bolt, owner of a fancy New York hotel, for his pretty wife, Louise. This was the Gilded Age, and the great stone stairways were as grand as love. But Louise did not live long, and the castle was never finished. She was never caressed by the light in the windows, did not stand in the highest tower admiring her view. Love is like this, a castle built for someone who will not enjoy it. So much time spent planning the light fixtures, the color of the carpet, while love's object is elsewhere. Maybe Louise wanted the castle, and maybe she did not. Either way, it stands empty, gazing out at the water, its windows without glass, its kitchen always cold, its room so bare, it's hard to believe pleasure ever designed them. Okay, I'm moving on to my daughter, who's in my poems more than she would like. She went to Catholic school when she was little, and I'm not Catholic, so they had rituals I wasn't familiar with. This one's called The Blessing of the Animals. At my daughter's Catholic school, there's a blessing of the animals, at which the children line up with their fat hamsters and gauzy goldfish, their dogs so old they can barely climb the hill. They bring their cats with bald patches and their lizards sleeping in cages under a fake sun. In the line to the priest, there are snakes with white eyes and birds without songs. There are ant farms and worms and rats with long exposed tails. The children wait hours for their animals to be blessed, for the priest's hand to hover over the weight they carry. They bring shoeboxes full of turtles, hairy spiders, frogs with dry skin. I like watching my daughter among the other children, her dog small in her arms, her gaze protective. Children believe in the power of animals, tucked into their feathers and shells. They believe in blessings, the sprinkle of holy water, each tiny, unexplained life. I'm moving on to coffins as a topic. In the past, it was possible to be buried alive, and I was reading about how coffins were invented to help people with this problem. coffins. People were afraid of being buried alive, so they asked that axes and shovels and trumpets be placed beside them. They wanted coffins with windows and air holes, lids that would spring open if their bodies shifted in the depths of that eternal rest. One model had a tube to the ground surface, another sported flags and bells and music. Any movement of the chest would cause a commotion. One came with a telephone so the deceased could call relatives and tell them it was a mistake. They weren't dead after all. And just like that, they would rejoin the living, stepping gingerly out of their hole. The coffin would open, the lights would blaze, and there, in the silent graveyard, life. The nearly dead would return to all of it. Spring cleaning, taxes, and death would become something that almost happened but didn't. Like one car skidding towards another but turning away. Like a storm that struck some other town. Like a season that never arrived. Leaves and snow unfallen. Night never short, never long. Okay. I'm going to get a little more grim. This one's called The Disappearing Fathers. A lot of the fathers in my family have been dying. Afterwards, maybe a hanky. Sometime after I turned 40, the fathers from my childhood began disappearing. They had heart attacks during business dinners or while digging their shovels into a late April snow. Some fathers began forgetting things, their phone numbers, which neighborhoods belonged to them, which houses. They had a shortness of breath, the world's air suddenly too thin, as if it came from some other altitude. They were gone, the fathers I'd seen dissecting cars and garages, the fathers with suits and briefcases, the fathers who slipped down rivers on fishing boats, and the ones who drank television and beer. Most of my friends still had mothers, but the fathers were endangered and then extinct. I was surprised, though I'd always known the ladies lasted longer. The fathers had fooled me with their toughness. I'd been duped by their jogging and heavy lifting, misled by their strength when they slapped me on the back or shook my hand. I kept imagining I would see them again, out walking their dogs on the roads near my childhood house, lighting cigars on their porches, waving to me from their canoes while I waited on shore. Okay, this one is about my mother. I'm covering all the family members. My mother's a painter, and this one's called My Mother Painting the Sea. She is sunburned in a folding chair, and before her, an easel. And beyond that, the eager flapping of the sea. She has been painting all afternoon while I have floated among the pages of magazines, wearing a wet bathing suit and eating a sandwich. Her hand seems to be made of color, and the scene in her brush is already disappearing, the day tired. She has remade the waves in a flat world without sound. On her canvas, it will not grow dark, and we will not pack our bags and walk through the dunes to the empty cups in our cottage. Painting, she is quiet, unworried, determined to make a life out of light and shadow. So a couple summers ago, actually the summer I was teaching here, my mother got sick, and so I have a couple poems about that. One of them I didn't put in my book, so you're getting to hear one that didn't go in. It's called The Dog Watched Television. The summer of my mother's illness, the one so hot and dry it might have erupted in flames, we discovered the dog liked television. She barked if we left her alone in the dim silence of the bedroom, but was cheerful if we provided a documentary about whales. She appreciated the Lord of the Rings, one ring to rule them all, Gollum, ruined by desire. The dog learned why prehistoric wolves were likely to care for their sick and injured, while we drove my mother fasting to the operating room and kicked the broken dishwasher and forgot garbage day for 2 weeks until the utility room became an odor. The dog watched Billy the exterminator capture raccoons and alligators and restore them to their natural habitats. She watched the Civil War and learned about our nation's parks, considered the troubles facing our oceans. My mother wept and raged and drank clear liquids and declared that none of us loved her enough, and the dog settled her narrow head on a pillow, her black eyes wise. So this second was written during the same time period, and I was reading an essay about how during natural disasters, two animals that are enemies will call a truce, which was totally interesting to me. And so I started to think about how it applied to people as well. Natural disasters. During natural disasters, two enemy animals will call a truce. So during a hurricane, an owl will share a tree with a mouse, and during an earthquake, you might find a mongoose wilted and shivering beside a snake. The bear will sit down in a river and ignore the passing salmon, just as the lion will allow the zebra to walk home without comment. I love that there are exceptions. At funerals and weddings, for example, the aunts who never speak nod politely to one another. And when my mother was sick, even the prickly neighbors left flowers and cakes at our door. Okay. Reading like four or five more, in case you're getting tired out there. I grew up on an island off the coast of North Carolina. It's where the Wright brothers flew the plane. And that landscape has really stayed in the poetry my whole life. So this one's called Living Beside Water. When you live beside water, there are two of everything, the house on land and the house in the sea, deep green, glassy, the porch disappearing in the afternoon. There are the trees that reach into the sky, thin and prim, then the trees made of liquid darkness, which even boats can erase with their going. When we float in our canoe, we travel beside ourselves and can reach down into the water to touch our own hands, which are clammy and flat. We press our faces against the faces we have lost. Our street of houses glistens and expands, its light lit twice, its details blurry as the evening dissolves. There are the real objects, piers, hammocks, laughter, and then the wet painting of those things. When I leave my island, I leave behind the only reflection of myself I've ever liked, the one that ruined Narcissus, who spent years pondering his beauty in the water. Okay, this one's a little lighter. It's a poem about wedding dresses. Wedding dresses. Packed away in attics, wrapped in plastic, pressed into boxes as big as coffins were the wedding dresses of my aunts and grandmothers. They rustled the way snakes rustle in a pile of leaves. Were they dangerous or angry? A single day in the world had not been enough. I found them with my cousins during games of hide and seek or while dressing up in other clothes. Floppy hats, shoes so tall we could not keep our balance. They had a stillness around them that reminded me of graveyards, their lace no longer white, as if time had steeped it in tea. They were fitted and stern, or showy as blossoms in spring, big skirts, trains that followed a bride like a history. Sometimes my grandmother took one out to show us and flung across the bed. I could see the shape of the woman who wore it long ago marching into the unknown. And sometimes we found a veil wrapped separately and it dangled like a jellyfish in our hands. The dresses were as empty as seashells. Like unicorns, they favored the attention of young girls. They were impractical, not made for dancing or reaching, meant to be worn once and then never again. They seemed both ignorant and wise, snowy owls perched in a closet made of night. I went on a failed picnic a couple summers ago, and so this one's called So Many Things Can Ruin a Picnic. So many things can ruin a picnic. Mosquitoes, for instance, arriving in a gray hum, or black flies, or a wind strong enough to blow napkins over the lawn like white butterflies, steaks stolen by dogs, unruly fire, thunderstorms that come on suddenly, clouds converging over a field where you have just unpacked your basket. It's amazing, really, that people have picnics at all, considering how many plates have fallen in the dirt and how many hot dogs have erupted in black blisters, how many children have climbed hills alive with poison ivy, and how much ice has melted before the drinks were ever poured. It's amazing how many people still want to eat on a blanket anyway, are still willing to take their chances to endure whatever may fall or bite. Either they don't consider the odds of success or they don't care. Some of them must not mind the stains on their pants, the heavy watermelon that isn't sweet once it's carved. Some must understand the way lightning is likely to strike an open field. Even so, they wrap up a few pieces of fried chicken, fold a tablecloth until it is as small as hope. They carry an umbrella or a jacket that they accidentally drop on the ground where it fills with bees. They leave the houses they built to keep them safe, and they eat uncovered, ignoring the thunder, their egg salad growing dangerously hot. So when I was a child, this island that I grew up on, we had a lot of hurricanes. A couple of our houses kind of floated away, and one of them burned down. So this one's called Floods and Fires. When I was 9, our house burned down. We stood on the lawn in pajamas and watched our rooms flicker. It was winter, and the streets smelled of snow and sleep. After hurricanes, my father, in a canoe, paddled through our sunken city. He found the roof of our garage, our mailbox filling itself with fish, and once his van rolled backwards and sank in a river while he stood nearby, surprised. Some people polish their belongings and hand them down from one generation to another, but ours are incinerated or they sink to the ocean floor where they join the shipwrecks, the cargo that will never arrive at its intended destination, the bones, the whales that once had legs long ago, before they stopped walking the earth, before they learned to sing. Okay. Two more. This one's a little long. I started keeping a list of things that I remembered eating and not enjoying, and so this poem came out of that. Called A Few Things I Ate. There are a few things I'm sorry I ate. A piece of fried chicken in an all-night diner that bled when I cut into it. A soup in an elegant French restaurant where I encountered a mysterious ring of plastic. Also, a bowl of spaghetti served with so many long strands of hair, I wondered who in the kitchen had gone bald. I'm sorry I ate the fast food cookies that tasted like paper, the same way I'm sorry I let certain men kiss me. I'm especially sorry I ate a certain hot dog on a train that had been twirling for days on a lukewarm display. Forgive me for all that cafeteria food in college, packaged, bland, frozen for so long it could not remember flavor. And hungry in my dorm, I ate bags of stale lies from vending machines. Once, even a pair of expired Twinkies filled with a terrible chemical cream that I am still digesting. After my daughter was born, I bought so much organic baby food. My husband found the jars everywhere. They were little glass wishes. And one winter, I ate exotic fruits from upscale stores so expensive I might have flown instead to a distant tropical island. And then, careless, I ate from containers only my microwave understood. I know what food is supposed to be, but often is not. I know who I might have been if I ate whatever I should have eaten. Remember the time we ate Ethiopian food and spent a week dreaming so vividly our real life grew pale, or the day we ate so much spice in our Thai food that our mouths were softer? I'm not sorry I ate all those ice cream sandwiches from my grandmother's freezer and drank those Pepsis with her on the way to Kmart to buy more pink plastic toys. She liked the way sugar made me lively, and anyway, she was suggesting the possibility of pleasure. She made a vegetable soup that simmered all day on the stove, growing deeper and more convincing, and a carrot cake with cream cheese icing that floated on my tongue like love. Now I'm middle-aged and overweight and eating salads or before bed, talking myself into rice cakes that taste like despair. My father's diabetic and must have everything whole wheat and lean, and my sister can't have any salt. I'm sorry I ate all that cereal when we first got married by myself in the kitchen, the milk pail, and worried. Remember how I covered my fruit with cheese and mayonnaise? I'm not sorry, whatever you might say. Then there were the lunches we ate on the beach, watching the seals sun themselves, thick chicken sandwiches wrapped in a foil so silver they must have been valuable. Okay. Let's see, back to the island. A lot of retired people on my island growing up, and I spent a lot of time with them. So this one's called Retired. On the island where I was a child, nearly everyone was retired, their fortunes already made. Death was around them the way water was around our streets. They taught me how to go fishing without catching fish. The tide's breath was marked in notebooks they kept beneath their pillows. One old lady fed me chocolates from a tin until my teeth were stained by greed. The old do things slowly, so I grew used to grocery store lines that did not move, cars that stopped in the middle of the road. One man spent a whole day helping me bury a squirrel. We wrote odes and dirges to the way it once hurried and planned. Okay. Final two. I'm going to end with one about my grandparents. My grandparents lived a really long time, and my grandfather just died. So this one's called My Grandparents' Generation. They are taking so many things with them. Their sewing machines and fine china. Their ability to fold a newspaper with one hand and swat a fly. They're taking their rotary telephones and fat televisions and knitting needles, their cast iron frying pans and Tupperware. They're packing away the picnics and perambulators, the wagons and church socials. They are wrapped in lipstick and big band music, dressed in recipes, buried with them bathtubs with feet, front porches, dogs without leashes. These are the people who raised me, and now I am left behind in a world without paper letters, a place where the phone has grown as eager as a weed. I'm going to miss their attics, their ordinary coffee, their chicken, fried and lard. I would give anything to be 10 again, a plate with them in that cottage by the river, buying Marvin Gardens, pass and go, collecting $200. Do you guys have a train that runs through this town? No, yes, maybe. Yeah. I have a lot of trains in my town in West Virginia, so this last one's about the trains. I love trains. The sound of a train. Even now, I hear one and I long to leave without a suitcase or a plan. I want to step onto the platform and reach for the porter's hand and buy a ticket to some other life. I want to sit in the big seats and watch fields turn into rivers or cities. I want to eat cake on the dining car's unsteady tablecloth to sleep while whole seasons slip by. I want to be a passenger again, a person who hears the name of a place and stands up, a person who steps into the steam of arrival. Thank you.
When I was asked to introduce Mark Brazaitis, there were two words I couldn't get out of my head: simplicity and elegance. As a second-year fiction student, after having studied with Mark for two consecutive semesters, I can stand before you today and confidently say it is these two principles which guide Mark Brazaitis as an instructor and a writer, and which even allowed me to correctly predict in advance that Mark would wear a neutral-colored polo shirt to today's reading. In workshop two, Mark prioritizes a balance between the elegance of language at the sentence level with more focused instruction on simple story elements. For a fact, the most success I've ever had with flash fiction has come from prompts offered by Mark, like, try writing a story with a plot, and create a character who encounters a conflict of some kind. At the end of the semester last year, Mark hosted an in-class publishing Q&A, which culminated with the question, what's the secret? How do I get a book published? And Mark answered, I don't know, just win contests, I guess. Like it's that easy. For Mark, though, it is. Mark's first collection of stories won the 1998 Iowa Short Fiction Award. His second, An American Affair, won the 2004 George Garrett Fiction Prize. He's won the ABZ Prize in Poetry, the Maria Thomas Fiction Award, the Richard Sullivan Prize in Short Fiction, the Javal Press Novel Award, and his most recent book, Truth Poker, was selected for the 2014 Autumn House Fiction Prize, a collection which Anne Pancake calls masterfully plotted and engrossing. Simple and elegant. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mark Brazaitis.
Thank you, Megan. That was great. Thank you. You know, my older daughter will verify that she and I were discussing what I should wear tonight, and turquoise was an option. Didn't win. Did not win the prize. Say thank you all for being here. It's great to see so many people here. Thank you, Marianne. Thank you, Jim, for many things, but for hosting Faith Sharon tonight at a pizza party that I... What did I do? I said, let's have a pizza party, and I promptly brought the poet to Jim and left. So I'm not a very good host. I do that with my kids with Jim, too. So thank you, Jim. And all my great colleagues in creative writing, what a program we have here. Thank you all for being here. This is quite a group, and not only the faculty, but the students. It's a real honor to be a part of this. And our graduates, terrific, terrific writers all around. So I need to preface this by saying I'm going to read three pieces. This first piece, any resemblance to an actual cat is entirely coincidental. Or mostly coincidental. Okay, I'll expect a call from his lawyer tomorrow. It's called Killer Cat. It was a coincidence. It must have been residents of a retirement home, in this case the Sunrise Manor in Sherman, Ohio, do die. Chuckles, the manor's midnight blue Persian cat, simply had the misfortune, if indeed it was his misfortune, who knew? If Chuckles cared one way or another, to be sitting on the heads of each of the three deceased residents when she, all three were women, was discovered. He hadn't asphyxiated them. At least there was no proof he had. There was, however, no proof he hadn't, because the families of the three women hadn't requested autopsies. Perhaps they would have if they had known about Chuckles' possible involvement in their loved ones' deaths, but Marilyn Baker, Sunrise Manor's director, didn't share this information with them. When her assistant director, an earnest young man who wore bow ties, asked politely but pointedly, isn't it their right to know? She said, do you honestly think Chuckles is a murderer? Good God, what's next? A homicidal hamster? A mass murdering mouse? Her assistant had his eye on her position. He was hoping she would die. He often thrust second helpings of chocolate pudding at her at lunchtime, doubtless intending to speed up the clogging of her arteries so he could rule the place. She was only 68. And while it was true that over the past several years she had contended with a series of infirmities, small and large, from conjunctivitis to congestive heart failure, statistics said she would live at least another decade. Mr. Bowtie, she thought, had better be best friends with patients. Mr. Bowtie wasn't the only person associated with Sunrise Manor who knew of Chuckles' relationship with the three dead women. Fortunately, the residents discounted the Chuckles as murderer theory and instead promulgated the Chuckles as bad omen theory. According to the paranoid geniuses behind this idea, Chuckles, like a figure out of an Ingmar Bergman film, knew which one of the old folks would be the next to die, and upon the appointed evening, sneaked into the doomed person's room. To assuage her residents' fears, Marilyn Baker announced one mid-morning before bingo that Chuckles would be relocated. The residents assumed he would be euthanized. No one seemed disturbed by this fact. They were, she thought, selfishly obsessed only with their own impending deaths. As far as they were concerned, the rest of the world could fall off a cliff. The truth was, Marilyn was planning to take Chuckles home, which, at the end of the day, she did. She had loved the cat from the beginning of their acquaintance, detecting in him some of her own cynicism and superiority. Besides, he was flat-out gorgeous, the feline equivalent of a matinee idol. Although she admired Bergman films, she preferred movies with handsome heroes and happy endings. Marilyn blithely planned to allow Chuckles to go wherever he wanted in her house at any time of day or night. But as the sky grew dark, she began to have reservations. There was nothing in particular she could identify as the cause of her unease. Chuckles couldn't have been more docile or more loving. He had settled onto her lap as she sat in her easy chair in her living room and drank rosehip tea and read Cosmopolitan, which she pilfered from Agnes Hopewell's mailbox. The old woman was in the early stages of dementia. She wouldn't miss the magazine. Chuckles purred whenever she touched him. When she stopped petting him, he expressed no discontent. He merely closed his eyes and drifted off into sleep. What, she wondered, was he dreaming? Of feline, female feline companionship, of catnip, or of murder? She knew this was a paranoid and ridiculous thought, but in the stillness of her house, she lived at the end of a cul-de-sac bracketed by houses containing families who religiously enforce an 8 p.m. bedtime. She couldn't help but conjure the worst possible scenario. Death. She wasn't ready for death. Certainly not death at the hands of a cute kitty cat, she said. With a false note of jocularity, she was sure Chuckles, even in his sleep, could detect. Better, she thought, to keep her bedroom door closed tonight. Closed and locked. Would it be overkill, haha, to put a chair under the door handle? Perhaps it was best, she thought, to be uber cautious. Tomorrow night, she would allow Chuckles greater liberty. Bedtime, my boy, she said. In order to appease him, she refilled his dish, although she had fed him only an hour before. Good night, sweetheart, she said, patting him affectionately, but without the warmth of an invitation on the head. Sleep tight. She slipped into her bedroom, locked it, and propped a chair under the door handle. In bed, she thought, I am one big coward. Imagine thinking a cat will kill me. Me! She could see why Chuckles or any cat would want to silence Jane Ann Fitzgerald. The woman had never shut up, and it wasn't only her abundant aches and pains upon which she discoursed. Say God bless you after she sneezed, and she'd preach an entire sermon. If Chuckles had anything to do with her death, Marilyn couldn't blame him. The same was true of Violet Ellsworth, who'd reminded everyone 12 times a day that her grandson was attending Princeton, and Nadia Garcia, who perpetually compared the fruit served in the Sunrise Manor cafeteria unfavorably with the succulent delights she'd plucked off trees during her girlhood in Costa Rica. But Marilyn wasn't worthy of feline assassination. The opposite, she had rescued Chuckles. Who else would have taken him in? And she loved the cat. He was lovable. Or was he simply seductive? Did he intend to lure her into complacent sleep before pouncing on her head? But wouldn't she wake up if she found herself suffocating? Yes, she would certainly wake up, but better for tonight to sleep alone. So she did, and it was a good sleep, a deep sleep, until 3:33 in the morning when she heard outside her door a faint sound. She wouldn't call it a mew or a purr. It was more like a low, deep whisper. It was accompanied by a sound against the door, not scratching, but almost a gentle knocking. Who is it? She asked. But there was no answer. She approached the door. Had she forgotten to push the chair against the handle? Or had she changed her mind at some point in the night and removed it? Whatever the case, the chair was off to the side. Was the whisper louder now? The knock more insistent? It seems so. The voice was more distinct. It might, in fact, have been pronouncing her name. Could some intruder have entered her house in the middle of the night, or was she imagining everything? Chuckles? She asked. She didn't know what was more ridiculous, his name or the fact that she was hoping he'd answer. She glanced at the door handle. In the pale glow of her nightlight, she noticed she hadn't pushed in the lock, but of course she had, hadn't she? Chuckles? She asked again. She heard what again sounded like her name, followed by a sound as of soft hands turning a knob. Slowly, the door opened. She was so scared she couldn't scream. But there was no murderer standing at the threshold, only soft fur rubbing against her ankles. Chuckles, she said, residual fear filling her voice. Her next words were calmer. Chuckles, my dear, sweet boy. His purr was familiar, appreciative. He continued to rub against her. She felt her terror dissolve, but she wasn't prepared to give in completely to complacency. She thought she ought to go sit in her easy chair, resume her earlier pose, Chuckles on her lap. She called the cat, hoping to lure him out of her bedroom, but he was no longer at her feet. He'd slipped under her bed. He's only a cat, a sweet, innocent cat. No, he's a possessed killer. No, he's only... She knew she wasn't thinking clearly. Exhaustion could confuse a person, and exhaustion carried her back to her bed. She told herself she would sit up. Chuckles couldn't very well climb on top of her head and wrap his thick tail around both her nose and mouth. She sat stiff against her headboard. Presently, Chuckles emerged from under her bed and found a comfortable spot on her thighs. He settled on her like a living heating pad. "And here I thought you were a thief, an intruder, a rapist, a murderer," she whispered. He looked up at her with his warm, golden eyes and seemed to smile. He kneaded softly, purring. She patted his head, his back. He rolled over and she rubbed his belly. He loved her touch. There was so much that could kill you, she thought. Just the other week, Thelma Mae Ritter's 23-year-old niece had been driving out of the Sunrise Manor's parking lot when she was sideswiped by a speeding pickup. No matter her seatbelt and airbag, she died instantly. But a cat? Marilyn said to Chuckles as she slid into a more comfortable position. His purring was like a lullaby. She yawned and her eyelids fell like theater curtains. A cat can't kill you. Slowly, she sank into her bed as into a warm bath. No, a cat can't kill you. A cat can only love you. Something pulled her gently deeper, and a great pleasure, or only an absence of her familiar aches, an absence of even the possibility of pain, spread to all parts of her body. Right, Chuckles? His answer came as if in a dream. His voice, she realized, was familiar. She'd heard it a long time ago, perhaps at the very beginning of her life, or even before. So Katie Ryan has a cat named, or was named Chuckles at some point, had many names, but I just couldn't resist that name. It's so, had such foreboding to it and such comic possibilities. So I stole that name, and then I will get a phone call from his lawyer tomorrow. I'm going to have a poetic interlude. Also, you might consider it a public service announcement. One thing that I would really love for this upcoming presidential election to do is for all of us to agree on facts, at least, about what's happening to our world and our planet. Just the facts. Let's just agree on the facts. This is called Golden. What were we doing when the last golden toad came to a dry pool in Monteverde to find a mate and waited lovelorn and waited despondent? Do you suppose we were driving somewhere? Perhaps we had the air conditioner on. Perhaps the tape player was playing a song we only half liked. What were we doing the next spring? when no golden toads appeared in Monteverde? Did we deliver pizza, keeping the engine running as we knocked on doors? Did one of our deliveries take us past the power plant, coal-fired and immense, puffing gray smoke into the sky like a sunbather smoking a cigarette? What were we doing in the second warmest year on record when the Antarctic's peninsula's Larsen B ice shelf, as large as the island of Hawaii, collapsed? What football game were we watching? What gossip did we share? What terrorist threat troubled us at night? What color code had we been warned with? And what color would be appropriate to warn us now of our melting world? Greenland's ice sheets, holders of 8% of the world's fresh water, are melting by 12 cubic miles per year. What were we drinking this morning? Whom will we toast tonight? Where will we be when Greenland's name becomes tragically fitting? What will we be doing when sea waters invade lower Manhattan and Miami and San Francisco and Beijing and all of Bangladesh? Which one of us on high ground will invite one of the millions of refugees into our home? Which of us will invite in 2, 10? Where will we go when the water is at our door? Where will we go when season after season, torrid rains are followed by blistering sun and no crop will grow? Who will tell the children what happened? Who will be the golden child, our last, to walk to the edge of the dry pool and wait? I'm going to finish tonight's reading, and thanks again for being here. This is from my latest book, and let me just say thanks to Faith Charon, too. And briefly, how I became acquainted with Faith was the old-fashioned way, through her writing. I had sent off my manuscript, this one actually, to a poetry contest, and I was a finalist. And part of the, I won't say prize, although it was a prize in the end, but part of the beauty of being part of the contest is you get the winner's book. And of course, when you're a finalist, you think, no way did that manuscript beat mine. So I get Faith's book, and I'm reading it, and prepared to, of course, hate it and criticize it and say, this is awful, and I start reading her poems, and I think, oh, that was pretty good. Darn, that was pretty good. Woo, that's a good one. Okay, well, I guess I'm a finalist. Woohoo! So that was The Owl Question. What a great book, and all of her books are great. I've enjoyed teaching her recent book in my 418 class, and always have. I think I've taught every single one of your books in classes of mine. Another trick we have as professors is teach the books we love, doubles the pleasure. I think I did write this story. Yes, here it is. So, Truth Poker, the premise is each story reveals some kind of truth, or a character potentially is keeping a truth from himself or herself that gets revealed at an inconvenient moment. For these narrators, you'll probably figure out what the truth is, and they probably eventually figure it out. It's called The Meat. The father saw the first runner crest the hill. The runner wore red like blood, like the blood of every runner he defeated, including the father's son, twice this year, 4 times last year. The father's son was 2 lengths behind the lead runner. And the father said, perhaps to himself, perhaps to the fathers around him, perhaps to God, this time, no. This time I win. I mean, my son wins. So the father in his jacket and tie, he'd come to the middle school cross-country meet from a sales meeting, jumped onto the course as his son neared and, racing beside him, screamed, catch him, faster, go, go, go. The father of the lead runner observed this unorthodox cheerleading, and he worried it might motivate the second place runner to pass his son. Seeing no choice and also relishing an excuse to do what he'd wanted to do at last year's county championships, where his son had come in a humiliating 6th place, he sprinted beside his boy, yelling, Don't you dare let him catch you. Run, Aaron, run! He had taken off his shoes in the cool fall grass. They'd been itching from a persistent case of athlete's foot, although his only athletic feat in the past few months was walking up three flights of stairs one Wednesday morning when the elevator at his law office was out of order. The father of the third place runner saw what the two other fathers had done, and he didn't want his son to be at a disadvantage. His son was disadvantaged enough, he believed, having inherited the opposite of a killer instinct from his mother, who regularly allowed in cars into traffic ahead of her and offered generous tips to mediocre waiters. Faster, he shouted, matching his son's strides. Third place is for losers. This race is ours. We, the other fathers on the sidelines, refused to be outdone or outmaneuvered or outbullied. We too joined the race, striding alongside our sons, urging them on in a language we hadn't spoken in years. Yes, even the father who had declared from the start of the race, of the season, of his life, that he didn't care about winning, that what was most important was trying one's best and savoring the journey and making sure that the means were celebrated as joyfully as the ends, even he unpretzeled himself from his yoga pose, tossed aside his peace pipe, and thundered into the torrent. Several mothers joined the race, some confused into thinking it was an opportunity to spend quality time with their sons. One mother, however, discovered she could help her son's cause by tripping his opponent's fathers. Another, she had large breasts and her t-shirt did nothing to disguise the fact, seduced several of us into believing the race continued across a creek, through a cornfield, and over the edge of a 15-foot retaining wall. A third simply wanted to show she was a better runner than anyone on the course, and she would have shot into first place if one of the fathers hadn't tackled her. The father of the boy who had been bringing up the rear, and perhaps even, sad to say, walking, was now driving him to the front of the pack on an all-terrain vehicle, its tires spinning grass and dirt onto the competition. Before the ATV driver and his son came within honking distance of the leaders, however, a father stuck out his arm and clotheslined both riders, sending them flying backwards into 26th place. Another father, a pharmacist or a doctor or a dealer, injected something into his son's left buttocks. And the boy ran faster than he had ever run, but whether because of the injection or because he wanted to avoid his father's next syringe, no one could say. One boy didn't have a father. Some of the mothers wondered if this was an advantage. We ran hard and fast beside our sons. If they had been horses, we wouldn't have spared the whip. They needed to learn toughness, and we would teach them. This was a crucial race, a decisive race. This was the third race of the season. Bad things come in threes, and we didn't want to be three-time losers. We'd lost enough. We'd lost poker games. We'd lost bets on the Super Bowl and World Series. We'd lost out on promotions and prizes to younger men and dumber men and men who were in all ways superior to us, which made us feel no better about losing to them. One of us had lost his taste for life and was thinking of checking into a psychiatric ward. Another, who was spending money like he had it, which to our distaste he did, thanks to savvy investments, had lost all modesty and moderation. Yes, we even lost abstractions, fearlessness, fidelity, faith. A few of us, the most unlucky, had lost children to illness or accidents, or in the case of the retired major married to his second wife 20 years his junior, to war. It was all the more important, therefore, that the children we did have keep pace with our wildest dreams and defeat our most haunting nightmares. Go! Don't slow down! Faster! 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 When we realized there wasn't much distance left in the race, we had mixed feelings. On one hand, we were tired and looked forward to a rest. On the other, we had so much for which to make up, so much to correct and avenge, and so little space, and therefore so little time in which to do so. For one father, there was the humiliation of being the only boy cut from his junior high basketball team. For another, it was the shame of being fired from his job last week. For a third, it was the embarrassment of his recent failures in bed with his wife, whom he was sure was having an affair. We had suffered failures of omission and
commission and diminution. We had failed spectacularly and quietly, publicly and privately. After our failures, some of us had cried. Some of us had pretended we hadn't tried. The grimmest of us, the fathers with the deepest wounds, wished with a terrible ache that we had died. But it wasn't only failure that motivated us. There was jealousy, spite, hatred. A father of a runner in blue was the next door neighbor of a father of a runner in yellow. And he was tired, goddamn sick and tired of watching from his kitchen window every Sunday morning as the yellow-shirted runner's father washed his late model Mercedes in his driveway, lathering it like he was putting whipped cream on a naked woman. Yes, much of what motivated us was sex. We wanted our sons to win, so the mothers who were watching and in some cases running the race no longer looked at us as the bearers of pot bellies and thinning and receding and graying hair, but as the still youthful progenitors of the victorious who could, with an invitation no more indelicate than a kiss, revive their lives with ecstasies unimagined. We weren't over the hill. We were about to catch a second wind. The course was now crowded and chaotic, and there was nothing the officials or the coaches could do to restore order. Besides, half of them had joined the field, desperate to do what they'd long wanted to, show these boys what it was to be a real runner, a real man. When you're this close to the end of the race, son, you don't hold back. You kick like a racehorse. You sprint like you're heading home to a naked woman in your bed. Or in the case of East Middle's coach, a naked woman and a naked man, you... But where is the finish line? Wasn't it supposed to be around this corner? Or was it the next corner or the next? We're breathing like we're in a steam room on top of a 20,000-foot mountain. We are losing our wind and our will. Is one of us walking? Has one of us fallen on the grass? Is one of us slipping off into the forest over to the right, hoping no one will notice? And where have our sons gone? Have they outrun us? But they were here only moments ago, by our sides, breathing the same air we breathe, their hearts beating to the same rhythm. Are you happy, son, wherever you are? Is this the race you wanted to run? Perhaps we have outdistanced them. Yes, that must be it. This shouldn't be a surprise. From the start, in our hearts, in our groins, we recognized our superiority. We are the alpha males to our sons' breathless, boneless betas. We hope to make them kings, but they're still only princes fumbling around our thrones. Who's going to win the race? What does it mean to win? Will winning do everything we want it to, or will winning be only another disappointment? Something we'll need to run another race to transcend or forget. Why these doubts? Haven't we outraced doubts? We are the captains of our fates, the masters of our souls, the champions of... Now here's the finish line, at last. But whose idea, whose joke was it to make the banner black? Thanks so much.
Thank you both. That was wonderful. We have books for sale and some fruit. And that's something new. I forgot to tell you about that before. Fruit. Stay tuned later in the semester for brownies. Yes. And some cookies, of course, and to talk with our writers. Thank you so much.